The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu. Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. If you love Atlanta, you can invest in the big picture. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
From WABE in Atlanta, welcome to this edition of Closer Look. I'm Rose Scott. Coming up on today's program, more than 42 million already depend on federal stipends for food. That's through the SNAP benefit program. And with the pandemic ending SNAP benefits, that increase that's ending, there's an urgency dependency on food pantries. So we'll check in with Tim Turner. He's a founder and CEO of Satisfeed in Gwinnett County, and we'll hear how the organization plans to help folks. And then also,
my appeal. Walk through closet doors and roam all over Coliseum floors. I step on stage at Live Aid, all the people.
Ah, yes, Funky Fresh. From streetwear to the runways of Paris, it's the intersection of hip hop and fashion. I'll speak with Elena Romero, co-curator of Fresh Fly Fabulous, 50 Years of Hip Hop Style. It's a museum exhibit up in New York, and also she's a co-author of the book by the same title. And just so you know, I'm rocking a pair of Adidas right now. So that's coming up. But first, a check of these headlines. Atlanta police and firefighters are continuing training for active shooter incidents. It comes nearly 2 weeks after a suspect opened fire at a medical facility in the Midtown area, killing one woman and wounding four others. As Shemaine Cruz reports, training yesterday shut down the historic Oakland Cemetery.
A group of law enforcement and first responders are running up to two people lying on the ground near the bell tower at the Oakland Cemetery. In that scenario, Paul Merritt, an instructor with APD's Critical Incident Training Unit, says they've been shot and the suspect has already killed himself.
We can't hope that it will never happen. We have to gauge our train, design our train, where if it does happen, our folks are ready.
Atlanta police and firefighters train quarterly for reality-based active shooter events using spaces like the Fox Theater and Georgia Tech's campus. But Police Chief Darren Sheerbaum says this time, they're applying some of the lessons learned from the recent Midtown shooting.
What we look at, how do we communicate? Are we communicating the information quickly and properly? We even look at things, where do we park our vehicles? How do we do the approach? How do we extract people out that are injured or people that may be taking shelter? So we're walking through all of that to make sure that we're even better next time.
Fire Chief Roderick Smith says the goal is to put personnel in different situations that they are not prepared for so they can be ready for the next mass incident. Shemaine Cruz, WABE News.
Georgia officials are still working out how to distribute hundreds of millions of dollars from a nationwide settlement with opioid makers and distributors. As Jess Mado reports, it's earmarked for addiction prevention, treatment, and recovery programs.
More programs are needed to improve Georgia's mental health and addiction services. That's according to Department of Behavioral Health and Developmental Disabilities Commissioner Kevin Tanner. He says that includes reaching people behind bars.
I think it has great potential for a high return on investment to decrease hospitalization, incarceration, homelessness, and reduce recidivism.
The 2024 state budget includes money for community treatment and crisis services, and Georgia is set to receive almost $650 million from the nationwide opioid settlement. Jess Mador, WABE News.
Environmental advocates are calling on Atlanta-based Home Depot to do more to limit deforestation, as we hear from WABE's Julian Virgin.
The Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental nonprofit, says shareholders should hold Home Depot's leadership more accountable in addressing deforestation. This comes a year after shareholders requested a report on efforts to limit the company's impact on the world's forests. Advocates say the world's largest home improvement retailer has an insufficient wood sourcing policy dating back more than 20 years, and that a new plan is essential for protecting climate, biodiversity, and people. The Home Depot Board of Directors has not responded to the resolution, but announced its intent to respond by January 2024. Julian Virgin, WABE News.
A federal judge is now weighing whether a lawsuit over Georgia's political maps should go to trial. It's one of several ongoing redistricting lawsuits that could shape the 2024 elections. WABE's Sam Greenglass has more on court arguments heard yesterday.
Republican lawmakers redrew congressional and state legislative maps after the 2020 census, but a coalition of civil rights groups say they dilute the power of black voters in violation of the Voting Rights Act. The plaintiffs say black voters were packed into a few districts to create a Republican-friendly seat in Metro Atlanta. The state says the maps are fair and should be upheld. U.S. District Court Judge Steve Jones kept them in place for the 2022 midterms, but now has to decide whether they should hold for the rest of this decade. One important factor may be a U.S. Supreme Court decision expected soon on Alabama's maps, which could sharply limit protections under the Voting Rights Act. Sam Greenglass, WABE News.
And finally, Georgia Governor Brian Kemp's office says he's making a trip to the Middle East to further economic ties between the state and Israel. Kemp is set to leave this weekend and meet with Israeli companies and government officials over about a week's time. It's Kemp's fourth overseas trip as governor and his second in less than 6 months as a Republican seeks to raise his profile. In January, he attended the World Economic Forum in Switzerland. You're listening to Closer Look.
Support for WABE comes from the Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta. You can go beyond giving to impact. Learn more at cfgreateratlanta.org.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
And Closer Look continues from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. Some news from Atlanta Mayor Andre Dickens' office today. Mayor Dickens and the Atlanta City Council say they're putting $1 million towards fighting food insecurity, which the federal government defines as limited or uncertain access to adequate food. Now, council members Andrew Boone and Marcy Collier-Overstreet spearheaded the legislation, saying neighborhoods such as in Northeast Atlanta do not have convenient access to fresh, healthy food. There are a lot of neighborhoods, actually, that do not have access to fresh, healthy food. In a statement, Mayor Dickens blamed that on underinvestment from popular grocery stores. The money provided to Invest Atlanta is expected to attract grocery stores of various sizes. It will also fund a research project that looks into the challenges of attracting big chain stores to historically underserved communities. And all that's related to our next segment. According to Feeding America, one out of nine people here in Georgia are facing hunger. For children, that's one out of every eight. And the U.S. Department of Agriculture reports more than 1.6 million Georgians rely on the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. That's about 15% of the state population. And that's more than the national average. Now that, as you know, means SNAP. When food insecurity spiked 30% after the first year of the pandemic, the federal government added an extra $95 each month. And already folks were getting about $188 in SNAP benefits, those that qualified. Well, now listen, they say those funds kept a reported 4 million people out of poverty nationwide. But now, that extra addition, it's ended. It actually ended back in February. So now what we're seeing, according to food banks and pantries, another organization, they've experienced an increase in the need. So we'll talk about this further with Tim Turner. He's the founder and CEO of Satisfeed in Gwinnett County. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Rose, for having me.
We've had so many conversations over this throughout this program on so many years. That extra, folks don't know, Tim, that extra money that folks were getting in SNAP benefits during the pandemic, that was greatly needed because for some they needed it before the pandemic.
Right.
Can you take that and share for our listeners who may not understand why that they may think that's a little bit of money $90-something dollars a month, but for a lot of households, that's a big deal.
Rose, the average family that we serve consists of three adults mm-hmm. and two children. And the reason it's three adults is because one of them is 18 or over. Mm-hmm. And that $95 that was poured into SNAP mm-hmm. to give them more benefit equated by and large to about five to 7 days worth of food mm-hmm. yeah. for the average family. Today, that $95 is gone.
Yeah.
And in addition to that, the gap is growing because of the cost of the food mm-hmm. and the scarcity.
And Tim, what a time to end that extra money, those extra 95, I mean, inflation. And you're right, food prices high.
The irony of it stopping in February is that we're entering summer. Mm-hmm. And Gwinnett County, seeing the issue was coming, went and purchased shelf-stable lunch products, and they will be distributing shelf-stable lunches Monday through Friday mm-hmm. at 14 different locations within Gwinnett County with no registration required, no vetting. Mm-hmm. You show up, and you're going to get the meals.
Yeah.
It's critical. I mean, I'm serving over 300 families a week, and we're serving more than 21,000 pounds of food a week to those families. In retail prices, that's equal to about 70 pounds of food, so about mm-hmm. $125 at retail.
Do you all rely on donations, or you also have to buy some of this as well, correct?
I do.
You don't always get a discount, do you?
Discount? No. But saying that, I work hand in hand with the Atlanta Community Food Bank. Mm-hmm.
Which distributes a lot of...
They acquire mm-hmm. and they distribute, and it makes our job a little bit easier. Mm-hmm. But they're experiencing the same scarcity.
This is not just a problem in Georgia, it's nationwide. Mm. So the food scarcity problem, is that due to, are we still having a backlog in supply and chain and groceries? And I keep hearing about the eggs. I heard the price of eggs had come down. I heard all this. So what's the issue here? There's food in this country, Tim, right?
That's the reason I got into the food pantry world.
Yeah.
Is because... I learned of a food co-op model being executed in the Summerhill neighborhood mm-hmm. and back in 2001. And I was astonished. I couldn't understand how the breadbasket of the world was experiencing hunger. And so Chad Hale was very kind to walk me through the process. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another. And I eventually called the Board of Education. I said, what is this? You know, what do you do to feed the students in the summertime? They're taken care of 9 months out of the year. And they said, well, we really don't have a program.
Yeah.
And so I stepped in.
Those 300 families, households that you feed a year. And I want to back up for a moment because I want folks to understand, too, when we think of who's receiving SNAP benefits, there's always this perception it's folks who aren't working.
Right.
And that's just not true. And I'll let you take it from there.
Absolutely. Over 90% of the families we're serving are Hispanic. And the age range is... It goes from newborn to 80-year-olds.
Mm-hmm. And it could be folks that might be disabled, too, as
Absolutely.
Well.
Absolutely. Homebound?
Homebound, yeah.
Yes, ma'am. And in fact, that's one of the things I encourage my guests is when they come on campus, if they know of a family in the neighborhood that needs food, pick up the food.
And I want to touch on something else, too, because communities, cultures, we have staples in our communities that we love. Are you also trying to make sure that you can provide those traditional cultures and staples of food for like you said, the Hispanic communities? Is that possible?
Sort of.
Yeah.
And by that I mean beans and rice, rice and beans. Mm-hmm. But we are focused on meat and produce.
Mm-hmm.
We can't find shelf stable. So
when you say you can't find, because you said that earlier.
It's not on the menu at the food bank. We order from the food bank on a weekly basis, sometimes twice weekly.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just not there. The food is not there. The food bank knows it, and they're doing their very best. And in fact, in our meeting the other day, they said, look, we know the shelf stable is not here,
mm-hmm.
but produce is coming. The growing season, the harvest season, produce is coming. And that's a real relief for us because I was able to acquire 4 40-foot refrigerated containers
mm-hmm.
and 2 40-foot dry containers. So I have the space to safely store and distribute frozen, refrigerated, shelf-stable, and whatever else.
So let's put this in perspective, if we can, for listeners who may not understand. Consider your organization and other organizations who are trying to help folks who need food.
Mm-hmm.
And then put that not only just in this region, but then throughout Georgia, then throughout the Southeast, and throughout the nation.
Mm-hmm.
So when we say food is in security areas, we are really, folks understand this is a serious crisis here.
Absolutely. And there's two terms that go through my mind. Food insecurity and food deserts. And because food deserts exist, food insecurity exists. Example. If you can't get to a full-service grocery store
mm-hmm.
within a 10-minute drive or a 20-minute walk, then you're, quite honestly, the only other alternative is the corner store. And the chances—
Which is high.
Oh, not only is it high, the chances of having—
Fresh
meat, let alone produce,
mm-hmm.
it's a real stretch.
Coming into this segment, I talked about what the city of Atlanta is trying to do in terms of, you know, with the research and look, you know, I have done stories about neighborhoods that were 40 years without a major grocery store. You know, some community, obviously you can't wait 40 years for that to come online. In the meantime, what does an organization like yours, how do you all survive? Do you have to limit the amount of food that you're giving to every household because of this shortage? Or
that's the question. Do we reduce what we're distributing or do we close? Instead of working every Saturday, do we shut down perhaps one Saturday a month in order to acquire more food so that we can then turn around and distribute to the rest of the folks?
How long do you have to wait for in between when there's this void? I mean, how long is that? And I know the food bank is waiting where you get your food from. So how long is a typical wait? I mean, I got emails here.
Days or weeks?
Yeah. Hmm.
But the good thing is the food bank put us on a grocery route. So 2 days a week, Mondays and Thursday mornings, we go to various grocery stores and pick up their donations. We bring them back, put them either in the refrigerator or in the freezer, store them, and then turn around and distribute them the following Saturday.
School is not out yet. So the 300 households that you feed on a weekly basis, that's going to probably increase?
Yes, ma'am.
To what? How many households, you think?
Probably another 10 to 15%. So, you know, 30 to 45 yeah. families.
Are you able to, can you get partnerships with produce growers throughout the state or farmers markets? Or?
That's a great question. There is a an organization in Atlanta called Community Markets, and I am starting conversation with them. I'm starting conversation with a couple of other distributors. But in addition, the Atlanta Community Food Bank has developed a relationship with a produce vendor that sources. So they go throughout the Southeast finding hopefully excess produce that hasn't already been committed to another source, so that they can, we can get it to the Atlanta Community Food Bank and the food bank can get it to us.
I have a listener that was asking, is there possible for you all to even try to farm or grow any of this? I don't know what your situation is like, but, you know, I mean.
I am looking at that.
Really?
But I'm looking at it from the perspective of the grow towers or freight farms. Because there is a freight farm up in Norcross. They have two containers, and their produce is incredible. They have restaurants, chefs buying from them.
Tim, organizations like yours, I know y'all try to stay out of the political fray of all this, but
I'm not allowed to step into the political fray.
But you are allowed to have an opinion about something. I've been having this conversation as long as I've been a journalist, and I know there's no magic solution. I did two community panels yesterday about mental health and the environment. So everyone says it's going to take partnerships to solve these issues, these crises. But we keep having the same conversation. Is this just something that, is it about political will? Is it legislation? What do organizations like you all need to help just meet this demand? Of course, some will say, well, we need to fix the situation to begin with, why people need food. But y'all can argue about that. How do we help organizations like you all? What do you all need? Is there something that you need from a federal level? Can the state of Georgia help? Is it about money?
It's always about money.
Of course it is. You're a nonprofit. We're a nonprofit. That's why we have a pledge drive twice a year.
Right. The simplest way for me to answer that is we, meaning the food pantries, have to have the physical will to go out and do the work. Because hunger's not going away.
Yeah.
It's it's like the journey that I have created for my guests to become ambassadors for Satisfeed. They're either guests who need food, or they are guests who come on campus to see. So I do a show and tell.
Real quickly, I want to go over this again because I have a listener that said that writes, you know, oftentimes some of these food pantries and banks require too much documentation. Is that an issue for you, or you all don't bother with that?
I'm glad the listener asked the question. Because I exist to feed hungry people.
So you don't need to see no ID and all that and where you live and all that.
I have a very simple registration form. name, address, phone number, email address if you have it, people in the family, race and ethnicity.
And that information is for data, because you need to tell people how many you all serve, how many households you serve.
Right. But I need to tell the story mm-hmm. to my funders, to my...
I totally understand.
But I don't have to report that other than the number of families I serve mm-hmm. and seniors, adults, and children, that's all I have to report. And the food bank reminds me regularly, we're not requiring mm-hmm. the additional information that some pantries are asking for.
When will you talked about earlier, if you had to make a decision in terms of shutting down one day, or when does it get to that crisis level?
Well, we already have calendar stops. Memorial Day, 4th of July, Labor Day.
Why?
Because I can't get the volunteers. So, and we are co-located with a church, mm-hmm. and the church has certain events where we need to be out of their way. Mm-hmm. And that's not a deal breaker.
Right.
And I already let my guests know we're going to be closed Memorial Day weekend. We're going to be Memorial Day Saturday. And they deal with it.
So it's just a situation where you need a facility or a lot, or how does this work?
That's a great question. Yeah. When I first started, I was co-located inside a church. Mm-hmm. I had 950 square feet, and we had 19 refrigerators and freezers.
Wow, that's a lot.
When COVID hit, we converted to the containers. Mm-hmm. So we now have four refrigerated containers and two dry containers. And we look like a MASH unit on the campus of the church. And the reason being, the church didn't have any inside storage space for us.
Okay.
So our goal is to become a hub and spoke, and to go to the different locations, different churches, different organizations that are saying, hey, we want to distribute food.
Mm-hmm. And you want to stay, obviously, up in Gwinnett County, area, too.
I have to stay in Gwinnett County.
You have to stay there, yeah.
But I have folks driving from 13 different counties.
Really?
They have come as far away as White County to the north, and as far away as McDonough and Douglas County. So it's, you know, they come and we feed them.
Hmm. Tim Turner is the founder and CEO of Satisfeed in Gwinnett County. Tim, first of all, thank you so much for what you all are doing. So many of the food banks, I mean, we partner with the Atlanta Food Bank, so much of what y'all are doing is desperately needed, so thank you. And
It's my pleasure.
Closer Look continues now from WABE in Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott. As you know, hip-hop is so much more than music. It's art, culture, it's a genre, it's a lifestyle, it's an expression, it's all of that. And it's undeniably one of the ways hip-hop artists and fans express themselves. Well, how about this? Through what we wear, how we look, well beyond beats and lyrics. Hip-hop and fashion has intertwined since its inception. Take a listen.
Yes, cold on my feet, but no shoestring. just change clothes and go. No, I stay fresh to death, water from the projects, and I'ma take you to the top of the globe. Let's go.
Let's exchange clothes.
No jacks, I got chips to gain. I'm like BoJack, baby. I'm hip to the game. I know it well. Rock Parada over Chanel, the H class with the
De La Soul on a roll. Black medallions, yeah. No gold. Hanging out with bars, hanging out with reps.
It's my time amongst the wise. Went through a garment renaissance and stopped wearing Benetton. Tommy Hill, Perry Ellis, Nordic, Everless, Claiborne. Ocean Pacific, Fila, Bill Blastingly fitted. Quitted Armani sweaters with a Gucci wool knitted. Now all these bars cannot cross colors. Sebastian Brothers, Mecca, Pully Pell, 88 North Cuban, and a few others. For the new year, strictly woo wear.
For the new year, strictly woo wear. I got some woo somewhere, boy, I tell you. From the 80s to the 90s, you name it, hip-hop had it locked down on the fashion. Join me now to talk more about this as we continue our Hip-Hop at 50 series is Elena Romero. She's an assistant chair and assistant professor in the Marketing Communications Department of the J. and Patty Baker School of Business and Technology at the Fashion Institute of Technology. That's a whole lot, but she's so much more than that. She's also the co-curator of Fresh Fly Fabulous, 50 Years of Hip Hop Style at the Museum of Fit. It's also a comprehensive fashion exhibition which explores the roots and evolution of hip hop style. Now, I say all that to say, Professor, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, okay? So just bear with me. You've been invited to a hip hop fashion show. And they say, Professor Romero, where would you want, what would be your hip hop inspired look? What are you going to rock?
My name belt.
Ah.
Hoop earrings.
The big door knocker hoop earrings.
Well, you know, they don't necessarily have to be door knockers. I mean, that's one thing. Hoops come in various different you know, sizes and thicknesses and colors and materials. But I think as a woman who is part of hip hop culture, I recently turned 50, so I'm on the baby end of the scale of those who were born into this culture.
Yep.
You know, that is something that really speaks to who we are. You know, our hoop earrings become almost like our superhero cape, right? It gives us a sense of style and power. You know, it's a throwback to our mothers, our aunts, to civil rights activists of the 1960s. So it speaks to our inner strength, and it's a way to easily be seen.
Mm-hmm.
The name belt is something that is unisex, that is vintage and current. Here in New York, I donated my original name belt from 1983 to the museum's archives here at FIT. And I recently replaced it with a new name belt that I had purchased in New York City on 30th Street and Broadway. And at the same time, I had custom belts made for all three of my daughters.
Oh, wow.
Who are now discovering it as Gen Z, right? So those are two items that I think immediately, you know, speak, you know, relatively to hip hop style, both on a unisex style and, of course, you know, the touch of femininity.
Absolutely. Now, everyone's getting this question throughout our Hip Hop at 50 series. I want you to finish this statement. Hip hop is
American culture. It is the music is the soundboard, and the fashion gives us, you know, kind of the tribe identifying elements, whether that is the clothes that we wear, mm-hmm. the shoes, the footwear that we rock, the accessories, and also, you know, the makeup, the perfume, all of those things, you know, speak to who we are and what we represent. Custom is a very big component of our style. And that speaks to our creativity and our originality and the aspects of larger than life kind of logos, or this concept of logomania, mm-hmm. is pretty simple. You know, when you're thinking about the early 70s, we're talking about children, teens from the Black and Brown community that are marginalized. We were othered. And so the easiest way to stand out, mm-hmm. right, is to shout out. you know, those brands that speak to us, whether it is because of our body shapes and what those brands signify. And so in the beginning, we were adopting the pre-existing brands that there were in the marketplace. Mm-hmm. Talking about, you know, the 80s, there was a big preppy trend, you know, look to Ivy. And then we, you know, start alternating that quite a bit as we start seeing our superheroes, in this case, rap stars, right? And mm-hmm. everyone that are all the elements in between, the DJs, the dancers, the artists. And then we start seeing more accessibility to other brands, and we look to designer or luxury. Mm-hmm. But then we have an influx of entrepreneurs who cater specifically to us and give us an alternative, an option, in many ways playing off that acronym of FUBU, for us, by us. Mm-hmm. That could be for us, by us, in terms of we were Gen X designing for Gen X, but then we were also people of color designing specifically to people of color.
And let's talk about this, because I have read that it took a while before some of those name brands really wanted to accept that they were being embraced by this particularly rap within hip hop. But then after they realized it was a $1 billion business, you know, at first not all brands were on board with being repped by artists, but then we started to see that change.
Well, I think fashion has had a complicated relationship with hip hop, and also, you know, the idea of specifically targeting consumers of color. You know, traditionally speaking, we may not be the go-to image that is being perceived as their target audience, even though we're a part of that audience, right? Their mass audience may very well be more Caucasian. Mm-hmm. And with a particular type of lifestyle attribute, you know, that they might dream up and design in their marketing and how they go about mm-hmm. then putting out the market, the product to general market. Hip hop changed fashion immensely from how we looked at perceptions of beauty and who walked the runway and the bodies and shapes that we saw on the runway and the hairstyles that we saw and the shades of complexions that we saw. I mean, we didn't see baldies and dreadlocks and braids and talk about different body shapes and positive forms until hip hop brought that to the runway. Mm-hmm. We took the hip hop celebrity from the front row onto the runway. And that then changed the game quite a bit, as well as all these moving parts that all happened at the same time. So we had, if we talk about the 90s as that critical moment mm-hmm. where the fashion really then, you know, kind of burst on the scene. Well, at this point, hip hop music has become mainstream and international. The fashion, those new designers, all of this stuff came out of what we call young men's or youth fashion. And so that's not necessarily marketed as, you know, sexy and glamorous. Mm-hmm. But those particular brands were able to prove through their volume sales that there was a tangible audience that had a desired need for these type of clothes, right? That spoke to them, their generation, their fits, their interests, their lifestyle. Retail starts changing. Mm-hmm. Those brands were built by the mom and pop specialty stores in our local urban neighborhoods. Eventually, those brands expand their retail distribution. And then we see regional stores picking up the brands and eventually becoming a department store business. Mm-hmm. And then simultaneously, we're seeing many more people of color on television, on film. We're seeing Will Smith's Prince Fresh of Bel-Air. We're seeing In Living Color. We're mm-hmm. seeing New York Undercover. We're seeing tons of films. So there's a number of things that are all happening at the same time, that whether or not mainstream fashion was looking specifically to target this market, they ultimately had no choice.
And then we see a little shit. You mentioned FUBU, and listen, I had about 4 or 5 Karl Kani, the vests with the hoodies and the matching yeah. shorts that were oversized. I had all that. I don't know where it went. I had all that. But you saw a shift in hip-hop folks saying, look, maybe we should have our own. Obviously, you think of Jay-Z and Rock Aware, and obviously Diddy with Sean John. Fat Farm, I think, was an early one. Is this?
That's happened for quite a while. The musicians quickly realized that they were a brand, and while they were making a portion of the proceeds on concert merchandise, right, they could go beyond concert merchandise or catalog sales and have their own brand, right, that they have ownership of, and now, you know, become entrepreneurs in a completely different lane. So we start seeing it. Chuck D had Rap Style International in the early 90s. Naughty by Nature had Naughty Gear. Many of them kind of inspired each other. Power from Wu-Tang Clan eventually then creates WuWare. And then obviously you mentioned Russell Simmons with Fat Farm and later Baby Fat, that he has Kamora Lee Simmons be the face of. And at one point there, you know, there had to be, you know, well over, you know, 25 to 50 brands. Every artist, you know, that was popular in the 90s and 2000s was, you know, putting their hand in it. Everyone from, you know, Cisco to Eminem and the moguls, right? You talk about Jay-Z and Damon Dash at that time with Rock Aware, and then Sean John, Sean introducing Sean John, and that kind of creating a shift in the business, and eventually Sean Puffy Combs winning the CFDA award as being the first African-American designer to do so. So we've seen quite a vast change in the industry, and musicians in some case, like, you know, making quite a bit of money in fashion, utilizing the same tactics that they utilize in marketing music and just crossing that over, guerrilla marketing tactics and product placement, for example.
If there is someone who would be considered a trailblazer or the trendsetter in all of this, I mean, we love talking about My Adidas with Run DMC. And let's be really clear. I know I went out and got a, well, my father went out and I had no money. My father went out and got what I wanted because I looked at what, yo, Run DMC says My Adidas. I had to get some, I had to go get them. But is there another artist that you feel, or artist that really kind of kicked the door open on this, how hip hop fashion really just kind of exploded? Who would you give that nod to?
It's impossible to give it to just one person.
Sure.
Right? Because at different points of the storyline, different folks deserve that nod or flowers, right?
Yeah.
So if we're going to talk about, you know, the introduction of Baggy, you know, then we got to talk about Carl Kanai. If we're going to talk about Deep Stash Pockets, we'll give obviously some credit to also to April Walker. If we're going to talk about brightly colored jeans, well, previous to Lee Jeans, we had Lee Jeans for color jeans, but then when we move it to our space, then that's cross colors, right? That spoke, if you remember those really brightly colored jeans and every
I'm not ashamed to say I had a couple
palette,
of pair.
Right?
Yeah.
And the cross colors guys were informed by coming to, they were from the West Coast, from California. They came to New York and, you know, got on the subway, headed over to Spike Lee's Spike's joint. A lot of people don't even give Spike Lee credit in fashion. Spike is definitely also someone very important with his store. All of his movie memorabilia became very important, you know, whether it was wearing the Malcolm X hat, right? Or wearing a Jungle Fever varsity jacket or baseball jerseys, you know, different, you know, She's Gotta Have It sweatshirts. I mean, there's tons of stuff there. And they saw how people were wearing the baggy jeans, and they just happened to, cross colors happened to have a much more cinched waistline, but then the baggier bottoms, right? So in terms of music artists, I mean, forever, I remember Russell pushing the Argyle sweater, you know, the pink Argyle sweater in Fat Farm. Sean John kind of elevated, you know, the luxurious fabrics talk when it came to the you know, you had the velour sweat, the black velour sweatshirt that he introduced early on. And he also pushed a lot of the dress component. And you saw a lot of, you know, you had, you know, mixes of fur and dress clothes and, you know, that Harlem swagger that you know, that's so reminiscent to when we think about time periods in Harlem specifically.
And do you remember with the starter jackets and the, now I don't know why we kept the price tag on the baseball cap. You know, as kids, we did some crazy stuff. that was a big thing, the big starter jackets, and it was people were rocking the hockey teams and baseball teams.
Well, think
teams.
About it, yeah. Right? So as much as hip-hop celebrities are our superheroes, so are our athletes. Mm-hmm. When you think about what Michael Jordan did for basketball, it was equally as impactful, if not for fashion. I mm-hmm. mean, we're talking about generations in that we're rocking our Air Jordans.
Yeah.
You know, so there are spaces that we did not normally see ourselves in. And each time we would be able to declare victory, whether it was through a rapper or an athlete or an actor, right? Mm-hmm. How we celebrate, you know, is to show off, right? What we can, our success. And one of the easiest ways to do that is through the cars that we drive, who we date, where we go to, where we eat, where we, you know, vacation to, and absolutely what we wear.
And with 50 years of hip hop style at the museum up there in New York, and then obviously with the book, you're taking everyone through all of it. How fun was that to put all that together?
I pitched the idea 4 years ago, just to kind of walk a little backwards before we go forward. So I mentioned that I am part of the hip hop generation, and I was a fashion reporter in the 90s. So I covered a lot of these brands and the changes that occurred at retail and the celebrities that got into the clothing business. So my first book told kind of the historical narrative of this. But now looking at the 50 years, I had a second chance to work on another book to really focus on the trends and the mm-hmm. oral histories and the stories. So I was able to hire many of my friends who are academic scholars, who are hip hop journalists and fashion journalists, who are all connected to hip hop culture to tell their version of it. And we told it in so many different ways. So, you know, we told the importance of dress shoes, because many people think that, you know, there's some stereotypes we have to break down mm-hmm. that hip hop style is just really about baggy clothes
and sneakers. Yeah.
And baseball hats, right? No, there's always been a component of dress. There's always been a custom component, whether it's tailored clothing, whether it's getting your airbrushed jacket or sweatshirt, whether it's, in our case, heading to Harlem and going to Dapper Dan shop to get your one-of-a-kind MCM or Louis Vuitton mm-hmm. or Gucci ensemble, you know, or talking to 5001 Flavors and wanting to get that outfit from them, or going to seeing Misa Hylton and what she's done, right? And how she transformed, you know, Little Kim, Missy mm-hmm. Elliott, Mary J. Blige, you know. And today to look at fashion and see folks like a Cardi B or Doja Cat become muses for these luxurious brands, to see them at Paris Fashion Week. You know, again, these spaces that were not yeah. meant for us, but we are a part of that. And quite frankly, have taken the lead.
Absolutely. But we could go on and on. Elena Romero is assistant chair and assistant professor in the Marketing Communications Department of the J. and Patty Baker School of Business and Technology at the Fashion Institute of Technology. And she's also co-author of a book, I say it, Fresh Fly Fabulous, 50 Years of Hip-Hop Style. I wish we'd get that exhibit down here in Atlanta. I would love to see it. Elena, thank you so much for taking time. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Take care. And that's it for this edition. Closer Look is produced by LaShawn Hudson and Daniel Razel. Tiffany Griffith is our supervising producer. Our engineer is Soria Vanderwerth. We'll have a link to everything we talked about today. We'll have a link to how you can get the book as well on our website. So stay tuned to 90.1 WABE Atlanta. I'm Rose Scott.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
The Gold Dome Scramble podcast is now plugged in, a WABE Politics podcast. New name, same on-the-ground reporting from us, WABE Politics reporters Sam Greenglass and Raul Bally. We'll cover local, state, and national politics as we talk to politicians and voters to break down each week's biggest headlines. New episodes drop on Fridays. Listen and subscribe at WABE.org or your favorite podcast platform.
WABE.